Welcome to the program. Another terrific edition of EcoTalk. I promise there's just so much news to talk about, mostly on climate change. But what bigger story is there these days? Like myself, Ross Gelbspan is a journalist whose career ran the gamut of news du jour, but who in the last decade or so has become convinced that reporting about crime and punishment is a luxury when much of what makes our planet habitable is threatened. A former editor at the Boston Globe, Gelbspan is the author of The Heat Is On, and more recently Ross has written Boiling Point, How Politicians, Big Oil, and Coal, Journalists, and Activists Are Fueling the Climate Crisis and What We Can Do to Avert Disaster. His heatisonline.org website is updated almost daily, and surely you can find links on Friday's big news. Of course, I'm talking about the release of the second part of the report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Last week, we gave you some previews, but now the report is really out. In our second half, we will be meeting artist and social commentator Chris Jordan. He has some provocative photos that speak volumes about our wasteful ways, and also we'll get a preview of the Green Apple Festival coming up soon. Welcome back to EcoTalk, Ross Gelbspan.
Hey, Betsy, thank you so much for having me.
When this part two of the IPCC report came out, there was only one guy to go to, and that was you. Thanks for being available to give us your analysis of what is part two in a continuing series of reports on where we're at climate change-wise.
Oh, thank you. Part two, as you know, the IPCC is divided into three groups, and the first one is on science. This one is on impacts. That's what working group two is on impacts. And so their report that was issued actually today, it's been leaked out bits and pieces over the last couple of months, but it primarily says we are headed for a very, very, very grim future, and, you know, unless we act very, very shortly. And so it's talking about things like as many as 250 million people facing water shortages. It's talking about 30% decrease in crop yields in Asia. It's talking about as many as 30% of all plant and animal species risking extinction later in this century as the temperature rises. It's certainly talking about the decline of glaciers and snow cover and so forth. So what it really says is basically that it's certain we're locked into at least another degree and probably more of warming, and as that happens, we're going to see very, very, very troubling consequences.
Did you want to be in Belgium for release of this report?
Did I want to be there? No.
Yeah, no.
not especially. The report, as I say, it's been leaked out a lot, so a lot of what was coming has been known. And where I'd much rather be is the White House.
If only you were president.
It's much more important that it get read there than by the people in Belgium.
Do you think it will be?
I expect it will be dismissed the way the president and this administration has dismissed this stuff pretty consistently. And so my big hope is that it will light a fire under Congress, who already is making some good noises. And clearly it should be on the front of the agenda of whoever takes office next. But I think the best response to this would be if it's really widely covered in the press and the public really begins to demand that their politicians start responding. I mean, I have to tell you from my own just sort of personal experience, I really find this subject of global warming to be a bit of a moving target. And I think the public is instinctively really freaked out. They know the weather is crazy. They know and suspect other things are going on. And my feeling is that this should energize a whole lot of people to begin to demand that this government and this country, as well as others, begin to start taking strong action.
So what do you mean by moving target? Because the news keeps getting worse, that people can't quite grasp it?
Yeah, partly the news keeps getting worse, and things that were considered off the charts and, you know, unthinkable 6 or 7 years ago are now becoming conventional wisdom. The speed with which the climate is changing has blindsided everybody, in particular the scientists. I was just talking to one recently who said, holy cow, we're seeing impacts now that we didn't project until 2080. So I think that the speed and the magnitude is really catching even the scientific community by surprise.
And yet, the
one area that I don't see responding, and the area that is critical to real responses to this, is the press, especially in the U.S. The press is covering climate change much more frequently and much better than it did a couple of years ago, But it's still not at all conveying the urgency and the magnitude of this problem. And so one big hope is that this report will really prod news organizations into keeping the story alive in the papers, on the news broadcast, 2-3 times a week, given all the aspects of it, given all the areas of life that it touches. And that, to me, would really be key to making a large difference politically.
I still think part of the problem is public denial. I'll tell you an anecdote. It's not a scientific survey by any means, but Friday morning when this news was released, I was at my gym, which is always my barometer of, you know, our mainstream moms in Marin County, people who are, you know, affluent enough to be able to have the luxury to think about these things, and of course who are at the health club in their big SUVs, and most of them are parents. When the news came on, there were like 4 women, you know, on the machines in that room. Mm-hmm. One of them was pregnant, and they all kept looking at their magazines. I swear to God, books and magazines. I looked up at the TV. I heard the news. I looked down. I felt like screaming, this is going to affect, this is affecting you. You know, I was thinking of Al Gore's line about how do you, you know, get rid of that space between, or expand that space really between denial and despair. He says, block the exits. I felt like locking the door and giving them a lecture, you know. They just didn't even look up.
I must say, it's important to distinguish between the attitudes and the coverage in the U.S. and the rest of the world. This is certainly not what the situation is in other parts of the world, and I'll tell you a little anecdote that happened to me last year that was very interesting. Right after Katrina hit, I published an op-ed piece in the Boston Globe, and it said Katrina's real name is global warming, and it put it in the context of all these extreme weather events and so forth. I got a lot of flack for the piece. I think I did something like, 20 or 30 radio interviews in the following week because it got picked up on the Internet. About a month later, there came to town a group of high-profile German news editors from publications like Spiegel and Der Stern and German Public Radio and so forth, and they asked me to meet with them to discuss journalistic issues in terms of covering the climate. And as a setup for the meeting, the woman who was organizing the tour of these German editors handed out copies of this op-ed article I had written. And halfway through our conversation, two of these editors at the same time held up this op-ed, and one of them said to me, Mr. Gelspan, no disrespect intended, but we have no idea why you wrote this. You're not telling us anything new. Why did you bother to waste the newsprint?
Huh.
And all I could say is, welcome to our world. So I share your frustration in a big way.
What do you think of John Kerry speaking out about climate change with his new book, This Moment on Earth?
I'm eager to see it, and I'm not sure what John Kerry's solutions are. To me, that's really critical. And the solutions that are required by nature are ones that really require, I think, major changes in our social and economic organization. And I don't know whether, unfortunately, whether John Kerry's gone that far in his book. I'm eager to see it, but unfortunately, I really can't speak to it because I haven't.
And in the back of the book, he does have something about where we go from here. The book is mostly profiling grassroots activists who are, with their work, doing something to combat climate change. But he does have an energy prescription for America.
Okay.
So it's interesting because he has, you know, a lot in common with Al Gore in terms of should have been president. And
right.
They both got the environment and global climate change, and yet were many feel too quiet during the elections. And they both blame the press for not picking it up, which I agree to some extent was the problem. But perhaps they still were not as loud as they now are.
Right.
Certainly Al Gore. We just have a minute before the spot break, but you're going to stay with us.
Sure.
Just wanted to get your impression of some of the politics seeping into the negotiations at the IPCC conference and just see what you think of the fact that Saudi Arabia, China, Russia, and the U.S. were trying to water it down.
Absolutely, they were, and some of the delegates were extremely angry about it. As a matter of fact, some of the scientists said that they don't want to take part in future IPCC deliberations precisely because the U.S., China, Saudi Arabia, primarily were the countries that insisted on taking out some of the stronger language. And as a result, a lot of these scientists felt that this does not represent the thinking of the scientific community, and it is really a flawed document. That said, I think that would be terrible if that were to happen. But I do know that there is a great deal of unhappiness with the scientists here, with the governments, rather, meddling in this process. And it's very clear that this is primarily because of the influence of big coal and big oil on the governments, which then have demanded these softenings and are censoring the scientists.
And have a vested interest in the status quo. We have to go to break. We'll be back with Ross Gelspan right after these messages.
Shake your knock, shake them off, duck, everybody. You're gonna take them again. You are your foe, your friend. You are the paparazzi. You are the tragedy.
Welcome back to the program, and we might as well be walking on the sun. It's getting pretty hot in the southwestern U.S., and according to the latest IPCC report, we're going to see more droughts, permanent droughts, they're calling it, because of the effects of climate change. Who better than to comment on this than Ross Gelbspan, who's made this his career, writing about it, speaking about it. Before we went to break, we were just getting to the, you know, some of the problems that they're predicting are going to be with us. And what's your sense of how soon in terms of droughts, wildfires? We heard a lot about rising sea levels in the first report. This one seems to be sort of the hellish aspects of climate change.
Well, that's true. And one of the things that the scientists don't know is how fast this is going to happen. I mean, there is a little bit of a lack of candor in terms of scientific ignorance, again, because, as I said before, this stuff is happening so much more quickly than the scientists had anticipated. But in terms of drought, for example, they are anticipating much more severe drought in the whole southwestern part of the U.S., and all you need to do is look at Australia. New South Wales, which is the breadbasket of Australia, has been locked in what seems to be now a permanent drought for the last 7 or 8 years, and agricultural yields have fallen dramatically. And that's not just because of extreme weather. It's because of some more fundamental changes that are taking place in the planet. So real briefly, just to talk about that drought, there are winds that swirl around the two poles. And as the atmosphere warms, it actually accelerates, it intensifies and tightens the vortex of these polar winds. So what's happening in southern Australia is that the water that used to evaporate up out of the southern ocean and rain down in the agricultural areas, these winds have tightened. And so as that water evaporates up, it's being drawn back into Antarctica. And it's actually building up glaciers in the interior of Antarctica, and at the same time, it has created what is entering its eighth year as a really severe drought in Australia. So these are changes that are even sort of above and beyond the normal extreme weather events that we're used to, and those are the kinds of things that the scientists are very, very frightened about, and they cannot predict with any kind of accuracy the timing of these impacts.
One thing we do know is that the four are already and will continue to suffer disproportionately.
Absolutely, and that's a major emphasis of this report. And it was also what Rajendra Pachauri, the head of the IPCC, spoke to when he was talking about the fact that the impacts of climate change disproportionately hit the world's poorest countries and the poorest people in the world's wealthiest countries. And that is very important to understand. And it's not because nature discriminates against the poor. It's because poor countries really can't afford the kind of infrastructures to buffer these impacts that the wealthy countries can. That said, in the really long term, it may be that really poor people in really poor countries are better off than people like you and me, because if we hit a period of runaway climate change and things really take off in a way that scientists are terrified of them taking off, it's really people who are used to living close to the earth and close to the bone
and simply
who are better prepared to survive than people like you and me who depend on our technologically insulated lives these days.
Interesting.
But that's sort of a long view.
And that's a silver lining in a small bit of good news in the otherwise bad news landscape. We would just have a little less than 2 minutes left. I want to ask you Ross Gelbspan's prescription for guerrilla climate change rectification.
Well, it's not so much guerrilla, because I've gotten great responses from other governments everywhere but in the U.S., but basically there are three simple strategies that are very large and very doable, the main one of which is to change energy subsidies. Right now, last year, the U.S. government spent about $35 billion subsidizing oil and coal. The industrial world spent about $200 billion. We're saying take that money away from fossil fuels, put them behind renewables, and a number of things will happen. First of all, the oil companies will follow the money, and they'll become aggressive developers of solar power and wind and tidal power and so forth. And I think those subsidy shifts would also bring out of the woodwork an army of energy engineers and entrepreneurs with a lot of clean energy devices and a kind of explosion of creativity that would rival the dot-com revolution of the
90s. We're seeing that in Silicon Valley now. There's a rush to want to help.
Well, that's right, exactly, and we need a framework for that. So we need that. We also need a large fund to transfer these technologies to developing countries. just about all poor countries would love to go solar. They have the most air-polluted cities in the world. There's no resistance to this in China and India and Mexico and Nigeria. They just can't afford it. And so we need a large fund. It's been calculated at about $300 billion for about a decade to set up clean energy infrastructures in developing countries. And then the third mechanism that really comes from a former utility company president is that would make this all work is a regulatory mechanism in the Kyoto framework, a progressive fossil fuel efficiency standard, whereby every country would increase its fossil fuel efficiency by 5% a year. And that means they generate the same amount of goods and commerce next year with 5% less carbon fuel, or they'd produce 5% more with the same amount of carbon fuel. And since no economy grows for very long at 5%, emissions reductions would outpace long-term economic growth.
Ross, I'm afraid we're out of time, but if people want to read more about your brilliant plan, read Boiling Point, How Politicians, Big Oil, and Coal, Journalists, and Activists Are Fueling the Climate Crisis and What We Can Do to Avert Disaster. Ross, thanks so much. When we come back, photographer Chris Jordan will show us up close what consumption looks like, captivating art depicting a consumption-crazed lifestyle, right after these messages.